Well, good morning. Thank you very much, Dean Thornberry, for your fine lecture. We have only, I guess, about 15 minutes before we need to take off and get prepared for Professor George's chapel address. So what I'd like to do in my time, I want to give everybody, and I'm sure Dean Thornberry would want to do this as well, allow some time for questions by folks in the audience. You spoke about many things, but I'm going to intentionally avoid dealing with those portions of your lecture that offered a causal account of historical events, including the Reformation, the 30 Years' War, and the rise of Nazism. On this, I will appeal to Woody Allen, who once said, "I'm astounded by people who want to know the universe when it's hard enough to find your way around Chinatown." So in this venue, I will stick to Chinatown. I'll concern myself with Dean Thornberry's reservations about natural law. He calls these in the paper, although he didn't say this in the lecture, more practical than epistemological. And he states, quote, "It appears that a growing number of public intellectuals are wary of the close connection between the leading proponents of natural law and their close ties to various faith traditions," and he offers as an illustration of this, an example, is Steven Pinker, who once referred to the human being as a computer made of meat. I don't know if you've, or maybe the brain, but pretty much we're just brains anyway, so I suppose that that would be his view. And one of the things that Pinker says, as Dean Thornberry has pointed out, is that the members selected by President George Bush for his bioethics commission seem to be populated by a disproportionate number of serious religious folks, and most of whom are Catholics. Now, like Dean Thornberry, I have an interest in this phenomenon, but not, as he correctly points out, because it provides us any insights on the viability of natural law as a philosophical point of view, but rather because of what it tells us about what our academic culture thinks of serious Catholics, evangelicals, and observant Jews. These sorts of comments, I believe, inadvertently reveal that on questions of deep ethical import that depend on a metaphysically rich understanding of the nature of the human person, people like Steven Pinker are out of their depth. They lack the moral grammar and philosophical acumen to actually engage the arguments offered by many members of the President's Commission. Because critics like Pinker have a heightened self-awareness of their own brilliance and accomplishments, they are incapable of confessing any ignorance on matters about which the New Republic and the New York Times Magazine has invited them to opine. For this reason, they resort to religious labeling and dismissal as a substitute for actual intellectual engagement. They realize, either consciously or unconsciously, that the academic culture that they inhabit is populated by an overwhelming number of political allies who harbor these same prejudices. Thus, they know they will not be held professionally accountable for their defamation. So rather than being dismayed at Professor Pinker's know-nothing bioethics, I am strangely encouraged, for it means that he has arrived at the table of public discourse without an actual argument. But it's worse than that. He arrives at that table with a cluster of beliefs for which his own metaphysical and epistemological commitments cannot account. Let me explain. Professor Pinker, as Dean Thornberry has accurately pointed out, is particularly troubled by the word dignity. It is as it is applied to the moral status of human persons in the Bioethics Commission's report of the same name. And yet, he offers an assessment of the commission as if we should take him seriously. But why should we? What if, in the heat of argument, somebody turned to Professor Pinker and shouted, "Please sit down and shut up. I am right and you were wrong and that's that." Now, I suspect that Pinker would find this treatment grossly inappropriate, one not consistent with the sort of respect a man of his accomplishments and stature should be afforded in such a public venue. He would indeed be correct. But why would he think so? Or why should we think so? Is there something about him that requires others to treat him with respect and deference? Perhaps it is his accomplishments. That seems partly right. But what is it about his accomplishments that demands our respect? It seems to me that they are impressive because they are the consequence of the development of natural gifts, that a person with such gifts is morally required to hone and perfect and not to waste on frivolity. After all, if in another possible world, let's call this a world that is inhabited by Steven Pinker II, had in fact spent his adult years as a couch potato collecting welfare checks, eating Cheetos, and watching Jerry Springer until he died as an obese loner in a Central Texas trailer park, we would rightfully lament the incredible waste of native abilities that not only disrupted Mr. Pinker's own good, but the common good as well. So we would say that Steven Pinker, too, by living a life of laziness and indulgence, did not properly respect himself. Thus, we would be correct in saying that in a sense, one ought not to respect people like Steven Pinker, too, who, when given the opportunity to hone and nurture certain gifts, waste these potentials in a life of sloth and depravity. But the respect not owed here is not the respect about which defenders of human dignity write. It is a second-order respect that is earned by persons who properly employ and nurture those natural talents that are equitably, not equitably, distributed among human beings and thus come in degrees, and thus cannot be the basis of first-order respect or human dignity. But the withholding or lavishing of second-order respect on a particular being makes sense only in light of the sort of being it is by nature, that is, a being who has certain intrinsic capacities and purposes that, if prematurely disrupted by either its own agency or another agent, results in an injustice. So the human being who wastes his talents is one who does not respect his natural gifts or the basic capacities whose maturation and proper employment make possible the flourishing of talent and skill. That is, the idea that certain perfections grounded in basic capacities have been impermissibly obstructed from maturing is assumed in the very judgment one makes about human beings and the way by which they should treat themselves, as in the case of Steven Pinker II, or be treated by others, as in the case of the actual Steven Pinker who was told to shut up and sit down. Thus, both Steven Pinker and Steven Pinker II possess human dignity, even if Steven Pinker I objects to our assessment about the grounds by which we should accord him the respect to which he believes he is entitled. Yes, I agree with Dean Thornberry that it is indeed disturbing that folks like Steven Pinker play the religion card when they are confronted with natural law arguments that are offered in the public square. But I don't think that the answer is to lament this state of affairs and or apologize for all the bad things that Christians and other religious believers have done in history. At some point, we have to summon the courage to stand up for and be proud of the wonders and accomplishments of our theological traditions, the glorious saints that have been inspiring examples of holiness for countless generations, and the goods that these traditions and saints have provided to the civilizations that we now inhabit. Of course, we must seek forgiveness from those that our faith communities have harmed. But not every accusation of sin is accurate or motivated by a desire for peace and reconciliation. Sometimes the unbeliever is just looking for an excuse to continue in his unbelief and to marginalize the believer from the public conversation. Here's my point. When the Steven Pinkers of the world issue their secular fatwas, we should call them on it. And we should do so by employing rigorous and clear philosophical method with good humor, intelligence, and graciousness. Remember, it is not about convincing Steven Pinker. It is about those that are watching, including those in our faith communities, who need us to set a good example on how believers ought to conduct themselves in the public square. Now, there's another part of, I want to leave some time for questions. Let me just be very quick here. I want to briefly talk about or mention the second objection that was raised or second concern that was raised by Dean Thornberry about that knowledge is personal. And I think that there's actually something to that that could be very helpful, especially in the public square when we have issues in which Christians and other religious believers arrive at the public square with a cluster of beliefs that many of us believe were rationally warranted in holding that unbelievers may not hold for a variety of reasons. And I think in terms of the way in which the liberal public square is constructed, namely each of us arrive at the public square with a set of beliefs, or as one philosopher calls, an evidential set. We arrive at the public square with these, and our opponents arrive there as well. And so I think that in some ways puts both points of view or both worldviews in a position to make the argument that policies that may interfere with our liberties, and in our case, our religious liberties, are unwarranted if they happen to come from a secular worldview for which we believe is not adequately justified to warrant any interference in our liberties. And so I've got a whole section of my comments about that, but I don't have time to actually deal with it. But I do think that's something it's a good insight, and one that perhaps we can talk about during the very brief question and answer period. Thank you so much, and look forward to your comments. Thank you.